From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Closure of Gaza suffocates its people, stifles its economy, and impedes reconstruction effort.
That was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Wednesday on his fourth tour of the Gaza Strip.
It's a collective punishment for which there must be accountability.
The UN Secretary General said it was long past time for an end to the present condition of the Gaza Strip.
This situation cannot continue. It feeds anger and despair. It increases the danger of new escalation of hostilities, which can only bring further suffering to the people of Gaza.
He also pointed out that Israel, too, suffers from the present condition.
We must not allow difficulties to become excuses for inaction. The risk of renewed violence remains high, and sadly, attacks continue, such as the deadly shooting in Tel Aviv earlier this month. Stabbings, vehicle rammings, and shootings have only one name, terrorism.
European Union leaders met Wednesday for the first time without the UK in more than four decades, declaring afterward their determination to stay united. This was Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, during a press conference in Brussels Wednesday.
Today, 27 EU leaders discussed the consequences of the British referendum for Europe. It was a calm and serious discussion, as it is a serious moment in our common history. Certainly, one issue is clear from our debate. Leaders are absolutely determined to remain united and work closely together as 27. We reconfirmed that Britain's withdrawal from the European Union must be orderly, and there will be no negotiations of any kind until the UK formally notifies its intention to withdraw. We hope to have the UK as a close partner in the future. It is up to the British government to notify the European Council of the UK's intention to withdraw from the Union. Leaders made it crystal clear today that access to the single market requires acceptance of all four freedoms, including the freedom of movement. There will be no single market à la carte. We also discussed the fact that there are too many people in Europe who are unhappy with the current state of affairs and who expect us to do better.
Condolences and condemnation in the aftermath of Tuesday's terrorist attack in Istanbul. Press TV's Matab Yaganifar has more.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has denounced the terror attack and called for coordinated international efforts to defeat violent extremism. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has described the attack as heinous and pledged Washington support for Ankara. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has also condemned the attack and called for stepped-up cooperation in the fight against terrorism. Several EU leaders have also expressed their solidarity with the people of Turkey and the victims' families. Also, French President François Hollande has condemned Istanbul airport attack as abominable and called for attempts to find the orchestrators. Meanwhile, German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has conveyed his condolences to the families of the victims, saying Germany stands by Turkey. Leaders of Belgium and Lithuania have also offered their sympathy to the victims and survivors.
The attack came one day after media reports that Russia's President Vladimir Putin had received a letter from Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey apologizing for the death of the Russian pilot shot down by Turkey near the Syrian-Turkish border last November and expressing strong interest in quickly restoring relations with Moscow. That letter was the subject of this report by RT's Marina Deshashi Monday.
Turkish president has apologized for the death of a Russian pilot whose jet was downed over Syria in November last year, and that's according to the Russian president's spokesperson. He also added that Erdogan expressed his desire to improve relations between the two countries.
The Russian president has received a message from Turkish President Erdogan in which the Turkish leader said he's interested in settling the situation connected with the downing of a Russian military jet. The Turkish leader expressed his compassion and deep condolences for the relatives of the killed Russian pilot and said sorry.
The attempt to heal relations with Moscow by Turkey may have been perceived as a threat to the U.S. strategy in Syria, which ostensibly targets ISIS, but which has seen repeated efforts to oust the Syrian government led by President Bashar al-Assad. In an interview Tuesday, political and military analyst Pavel Flegengauer said this.
Russia wants to keep all these different diverse nations into some kind of coalition under Russian auspices. But it's very important for Russia that Assad is part of that coalition. And Turkey has to agree with that. And that is a kind of hard thing for Turkey to swallow.
When asked why Turkey was seeking the rapprochement with Russia 7 months after the shootdown, former Turkish Foreign Minister Yasha Yakish told RT this.
I don't think that it can be explained with one single event. First of all, Turkey was isolated in the international arena because of the difficulties with several countries at the same time. And the change in the post of the prime minister, that's to say, Davutoğlu was replaced by another prime minister, Mr. Binali Yildirim. And this was a golden opportunity to launch new initiatives in the foreign policy as well. It was a little difficult to do something similar like this when Davutoğlu became prime minister, because Davutoğlu was foreign minister before he became prime minister. So many foreign policy initiatives were started by Davutoğlu. When he became prime minister, it was difficult for him to change these foreign policies because he was the one who initiated the foreign policy. And now that he is sitting in the post of the in the seat of the prime minister, he cannot change that. I'm going to change now. He cannot say that he's going to change the foreign policy. Whereas when there is a new prime minister, it is a golden opportunity for Turkey to adjust Turkey's foreign policy to the realities in the field, and this is what Turkey is doing now, both with Russia and also with Israel.
For more on the implications of the recent attack at Istanbul and the rapprochement between Turkey and Russia, we spoke with Eric Dreitzer, political analyst, radio host, and executive editor of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Don.
So, hell of a coincidence. You have 7 months after the shootdown of a Russian plane by Turkey and a major chill in the relationship between the two, almost war. And suddenly, rapprochement attempt by the prime minister of Turkey and, I'm sorry, by the president of Turkey, and within 24 hours, this event in Istanbul.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what to make of the coincidence of the timing other than to say that it's not the first time that we've seen a similar confluence of events and interests. We saw the bombings that happened in Ankara and in Istanbul previous to this, each of which coincided directly with both events on the ground changing in Syria and especially with the Turkish state's onslaught against the Kurds. And of course, those attacks certainly provided the needed political and public relations justification for those attacks against the Kurdish forces, against the PKK, but actually against Kurdish civilians, which is really the main thrust of those operations. So similarly, we've seen here just in the last 24, 48 hours, a momentous move by President Erdogan to make this formal apology to Russia even though I suppose there could be questions about just how genuine the apology was. But in any event, the apology was made. And then, you know, literally just hours later, you have this attack. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. We can't say for certain. We can certainly speculate. Particularly, I think we should go back to the intimate role that Turkish intelligence, the MIT, has played in fomenting the war in Syria. Obviously, the information has all come out in public thanks to people like the Turkish journalists who are facing criminal charges under the Erdogan regime from the various media outlets such as the Cumhuriyet, like Kandundar and the Cumhuriyet, and other very important publications in Turkey, which have made it well known, publicly understood, that Turkish intelligence has been sending arms and terrorists into Syria to foment the ongoing war there. So if we see what's happened in Turkey as the logical consequence of that, then one obviously, I think, just as a general investigator, must ask the question, what was Turkish intelligence doing? What connection does Turkish intelligence have with those who carried out this attack? What connection does President Erdogan have with the very policies, with the handlers and the technicians and all of the people who are intimately involved in this project over the border in Syria? This question obviously needs to be asked. Of course, nobody in the corporate media will touch that issue. So I suppose it remains for us in the alternative media to really question not just the timing, but the significance of what's happened.
You know, and at RT, for example, Lizzie Phelan has filmed at the border with Turkey, Turkish assistance to ISIS, or ISIS having free reign and free run across the border. And they've found accounting books of the trade in oil with ISIS, between ISIS and people in Turkey, and other revelations that show actually Turkey working hand in glove with ISIS. And so is this an attack against Turkey that illustrates that there's now a different relationship between ISIS and Turkey, or is this a hand-in-glove move, basically, that allows Turkey to now go after, you know, again, Kurds and others?
Well, I suppose either one of those is possible, and they're maybe not even necessarily mutually exclusive, because obviously the ISIS organization is complex. It has a lot of moving parts. There are obviously key figures inside of the organization, particularly those who are involved in bringing in the weapons and bringing out the oil and selling it on the black markets. They obviously quite clearly have connections to the Turkish state, even if it's just individuals inside of the Turkish state. But at the broader level, I think the real question that you're asking is, are we seeing a significant change in policy here? Are we seeing this is a turning point for Erdogan and the Turkish government vis-a-vis Syria, and of course, by extension, vis-a-vis Russia? I'm skeptical of that. I don't know that we have the evidence to make that conclusion. What I will say, though, is that this could be, and this is possible, this could be a signal that Erdogan understands that his project in Syria has failed, that his attempt to really destroy Syria, to destroy the Syrian government, and to put in its place a proxy of the AKP, of Erdogan's party, of the Muslim Brotherhood, one that would be compliant to Turkish diktats, that is not happening. And so it could be that Erdogan has made the calculation that risking his relationship with Russia and risking potential economic future for Turkey, given the extensive relations it had with Russia, might not be worth the cost of this project. I think that that is certainly on the table. And then I think secondarily, there is, of course, the question of the U.S. and of NATO. Remember, Turkey is a member of NATO. NATO. It is one of the important members of NATO, one that has been really an outpost against Russia for many decades. That's how NATO saw Turkey during the Cold War, as really that crossroads. Anybody who is familiar with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and some of the other spy novels knows that Turkey was one of the major battlegrounds of espionage and covert activity all throughout the Cold War. And I think that we see similarly today, Turkey trying to play this role as being a member of NATO and allied to the West, but also having some kind of connections to Russia. And it seems that Erdogan has finally perhaps gotten the message that you cannot challenge Russia, you cannot have an adversarial relationship with Russia, not the least of which because Europe isn't backing you. So there is that, I think, geopolitical calculation. And then more specifically, of course, there is this war against the Kurds that shouldn't be underplayed. Will this be yet another example of Erdogan using this sort of event to wage yet more war against the Kurdish people? This is a very real possibility as well. Certainly the people of the Kurdish territories inside of Turkey are fearful of that. We don't yet know exactly what's going to come out of any investigation into who carried out this attack. Obviously, we've seen Erdogan try to pin everything on the PKK, try to pin everything on Kurdish terrorism. We don't know how this is going to go. But what we can say for certain is that whatever is happening here, Turkey is in turmoil.
You know, you mentioned that this has a lot of moving parts, and one of the moving parts is the fact that Turkey relies on its tourism industry pretty heavily. It's a very important part of the national income. And, of course, one of the large factors has been Russian tourists over the years. And this year there was a call for a boycott. And apparently there's been pressure on Erdogan from the tourism industry. And I'm wondering if that isn't why an attack on an airport was made, which, of course, Istanbul would chill very much the tourism industry.
Could be. I tend to be a little bit more skeptical of tourism as really playing a central role in Erdogan's thinking. Certainly it hurts in the short term, but tourism is also one of those industries where if one segment of your tourist industry is lagging, you can make up for it by attracting tourists from other parts of the world. I think that Turkey is very much capable of doing that, and I don't think that a president as headstrong and as obstinate as Erdogan would necessarily change the entire political course of his administration and more broadly his foreign policy over some Russian tourists not coming to the country. I think that there's much more to it, and I'm not suggesting you're saying that's the only reason, but rather that that factors in. I understand that.
Right. Well, I only mention it because it's the beginning of the tourism season now there.
Right, and I understand that, and it could play a role in it certainly. But I think that more broadly, it has to do with Erdogan understanding, being able to see reality or read the tea leaves or however you want to put it. He understands what's happening in Syria. He knows that it's not going to go the way that he wanted it to go in 2012 and in 2013. He knows that those Syrian expats who he's housing in Turkey, who allegedly wanted to become the new government of Syria once Assad had been removed, that's not happening. That project has failed. So why would he continue building his house on a sinking foundation? Rather, I think he's trying to change the entire calculus of the situation to try to mend fences with Russia, to try to get on Russia's good side so that Turkey has a role in a post-war Syria. Ultimately, I think that that's one of the most significant issues here. Will Turkey have a role in post-war Syria? Will any of the so-called opposition in Syria, who will undoubtedly be part of a political process, I think there's no doubt that that's what's going to happen, will they have Erdogan behind them, backing them, therefore making Erdogan part of the post-Syria political or post-war political landscape in Syria? I think that that is a much more significant angle for Erdogan, because ultimately this entire project was about projecting projecting Turkish power beyond Turkey's borders. It is an imperial project, a neo-Ottoman project, as many of us have been writing and saying for a long time. And that's really, I think, how it needs to be seen. Erdogan is not only a megalomaniac and, you know, egocentric and a narcissist. Erdogan also does have an understanding of reality here. And I think he understands that the cards have not gone his way. And so now it's time to change the game.
Yeah, on that point, you know, this is happening also within the context. Less than a week after the Brexit vote, the on-again, off-again relationship between Turkey and the EU and its membership and, you know, the billiard ball that got thrown across the table of Brexit last week, with everything sort of certainly rebounding from it or in flux from it. So I'm wondering if perhaps he's not looking to re-leverage his position in terms of negotiating with the EU. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it could be, although the on-again, off-again, love-hate relationship between Turkey and the EU is quite mercurial, to say the least. And I'm not sure that anybody would be, you know, putting too much stock into Turkey becoming a member of the EU, especially with all of this sort of rankled, you know, feelings and egos, once it became clear that Erdogan was essentially extorting the European Union over the refugee issue. So I don't know whether Erdogan really sees himself and Turkey as being part of the European Union, but I do think that Erdogan is positioning himself for what he believes is coming in the near future. And there's a couple of things that I think need to factor into that calculus. Number one has to do with, as you mentioned, economic concerns. Economic concerns, these are Russia, economic concerns about the standing of Turkey in the region with respect, of course, to Iran and Saudi Arabia, and of course, this continuing rapprochement that shouldn't be ignored between Turkey and Israel. Again, this is all about positioning in the region for the near future and the medium term and the long term, and I think that's how Erdogan is thinking. And I think we also need to really keep in mind that Erdogan is not ignorant of U.S. politics. There is an election coming, an election that, you know, regardless of what people say, I think it's the by far the more likely outcome is that we will see a President Hillary Clinton. And if that happens, one would be safe to bet that the U.S. will escalate and escalate quickly and escalate quite significantly its operations in Syria, perhaps even going so far as putting in the much touted by Erdogan no-fly zones and humanitarian corridors. So it might be that Erdogan is trying to improve his position with Russia as a temporary measure, knowing that in the near future, the U.S. is going to become much more hawkish on Syria and will back Turkey's project. So it might be that he's essentially trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Do you think that the recent SCO meeting, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the display of friendship, to put it mildly, but the announcement really of a strategic partnership between Russia and China is factored into this?
Certainly, but again, I don't know that it necessarily means that Turkey, you know, is all that concerned about upsetting China. I think that Turkey, if they were really concerned about upsetting China, they would stop having involvement with the Uyghur separatist movement. They would stop having involvement with international terrorism that comes out of the Xinjiang province. I think it's quite clear because of a lot of documented evidence, including the forged passports by certain operatives from Turkey, including the human trafficking networks going into Xinjiang from Turkey and all of the rest of these issues, that Turkey doesn't necessarily take too seriously the question of upsetting Beijing. I think that more generally, Turkey's concern is that it's going to get left out in the cold by the West and that it needs to have some kind of a countermeasure, that being at least some semblance of a relationship with the rising integration processes happening in the East. And so, again, I come back to this notion of Turkey as essentially a crossroads regional power, one that attempts to straddle the line between East and West. I mean, just geographically, historically, the Bosphorus Straits, I mean, this critical choke point globally, this is seen as the crossroads between Europe and Asia, between East and West. Turkey is well situated to play that role politically, and I think that's how it's playing out. So obviously, he's looking at what's happening in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, but even within the SCO, there are problems and there are conflicts. I don't think any reasonable political observer or analyst would argue that by acceding to the SCO, somehow India and Pakistan are going to magically resolve all of their issues. I don't think that that's happening. I don't think anybody believes that's what's going to happen. So there are even problematic elements within the SCO, but certainly putting all of your eggs in the Western NATO basket, I think Erdogan is probably correct in thinking they will just drive the knife right into his back as soon as it is most convenient for them. So he's trying to do it first.
And then, of course, despite the belief that you have that that Clinton is going to win, the possibility exists that Trump will win or somebody else. But dealing with Trump specifically, either his foreign policy, despite what he says, will be a continuation of what we've had for quite some time now, or it will be radically different. And if it's different, one of the points that he's mentioned has been NATO. Do you think there's some concern on Erdogan's part that he might get left holding the bag under that scenario?
Could be. I would question the political acumen if that's really what he's concerned about, because on the off chance that Trump were to somehow pull off some kind of an upset in this election and actually become president, which I don't think is likely, but if that were to happen, then it's a much larger open question whether any of his bluster and bluff regarding NATO would actually come to fruition. Remember that NATO, the U.S., the military arm of U.S. power projection, is something that is not up for negotiation for any individual administration. It's something that spanned on many decades. It's something that is in many ways far larger than just a U.S. president, and not something that is really, it's not even like the EU. It's not something that can be renegotiated exactly. It is military power, pure and simple, and I personally do not buy the idea that Trump is somehow, some kind of anti-NATO voice. I think he raised questions about the economics of NATO and of funding NATO in that way, and might there be some kind of modification of that? I suppose there's a potential for talking about it, but a substantive change to NATO under Trump, I don't buy it, and I would be very surprised if Erdogan and his people bought that as well. The Turkish government is not ignorant of U.S. politics. I think they understand it clearly, and I think that what they might be concerned about is the fact that a Trump victory would mean surely continued defeat for Turkey in Syria. It is Hillary Clinton who is really the more hawkish of the two on Syria. Now, don't get me wrong. Trump's got Walid Fares. Trump's got a bunch of other neocons who are in his ear talking about these policies, who support Israel, who support genocide against Palestinians, who support aggression in the region. So I'm not suggesting that Trump is some kind of anti-war, dove on these issues. But when set against Hillary Clinton, certainly it's clear where Erdogan would like to see it go. And I think that Erdogan would be right to prepare for a President Clinton.
And finally, do you think that the attack at Istanbul will have an impact on the movement that Erdogan set in motion earlier towards Russia?
It will provide some level of political cover for Erdogan to say that he needs to have positive relations with Russia. Basically, it can go hand in hand with this rapprochement with Moscow. It's not so much about the shooting down of the Russian jet. I think that's pretty much a secondary issue at this point. I think what's primarily concerning to Erdogan and his government is that Russia has clearly demonstrated that they're willing to take on a pretty significant counterterrorism operation, and that what Erdogan is going to do is to translate what's happened in Istanbul into a counter-terror political currency, one that's going to give him the cover he needs to be able to say, look, we got to work with Russia. We got to work with Putin. They are the ones who are really fighting against this menace of terrorism, which keeps biting us every few months here in Turkey. So it's a way of justifying an about-face in terms of policy Erdogan's main concern was about saving face. He knew he needed to get back into the good graces of Putin, and he needed a way to do that. Making an apology is only one step. The other step is to provide the political backdrop in which an apology and future cooperation is not only palatable, but is necessary. Ultimately, he needs to be able to tell the people of Turkey, look, we need Russia, we need to work with Russia, and I'm the one who's going to do that.
Eric Dreitzer, StopImperialism.org. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.